So much has changed in the world because of the ability to connect with people instantly. I mean, TV stations used to pay a great deal of money to go live to Washington on the evening news. Now anybody can go live from pretty much anywhere on the planet with a smartphone and Facebook Live. Social media, Facebook and Twitter et al., make everything from desserts to war different. We'll put the desserts aside for this hour and focus on war. David Patrick Karakos did in his book, War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. David Patrick Karakos is a journalist with credits at the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and plenty of other publications. He's a contributing writer at Politico, a contributing editor at the Daily Beast, and the author of a previous book, Nuclear Iran, The Birth of an Atomic State. David Patrick Karakos, thanks for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with Iran and atomic weapons. Are we reaching the point where actual weapons of destruction are becoming superfluous, where cyber weapons really rule the day?
Well, that's a very good question. Obviously, we live in a world where nuclear weapons are the ultimate deterrent, and if any are used, then it could be the end of us all, so they can't be discounted. But I think what we're moving into, and what the Russians are especially or acutely aware of, is that actually non-military means can be more effective than military means. And we're getting to a stage, interestingly, where, once propaganda campaigns supported military campaigns on the ground, increasingly we're seeing military campaigns on the ground support propaganda campaigns on TV and in cyberspace, which is, a total inversion of traditional warfare. And this is something very new because obviously propaganda itself is as old as warfare itself and politics itself.
Well, as you mentioned, the Russians, so let's move with that. The book starts in Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. What did you see happening there?
Well, look, what I found so interesting in my time, these sort of 8 months I spent in Ukraine, is what birthed the idea for this book. Now, if you look at traditional warfare, the Prussian military theorist Clausewitz famously said, war is the continuation of politics with other means, by other means. Now, I came to understand that what I was looking at was armed politics, that there wasn't a distinction. And I'll tell you why. Now, under traditional ideas of war, two or more sides would have a fight. The area would be almost as geographically delineated as a boxing ring. And the winner would then impose a political settlement on the loser, which the loser would have to accept. Examples of this are the Treaty of Versailles after World War I, and obviously the defeat of the Nazis by the Allied powers in World War II. The Nazis were utterly defeated. They were forced to surrender. And, conditions were put on them that they had to accept. But what I saw in Ukraine was something different. Now, Putin, Russian President Vladimir Putin, had no intention of defeating Ukraine and forcing it to the table to accept the loss of eastern Ukraine. And he easily could have done that. Russia could easily, especially in those early days, have rolled into Kiev pretty much unopposed. What he wanted to do was he sent soldiers across the border to destabilize Ukraine. And how he did this was by, occupying these cities and allowing a space to pump in propaganda via TV and social media that said that the Kiev government was a fascist junta. I heard this again and again and again, that they wanted to destroy the speaking of Russian in eastern Ukraine and that they wanted to persecute eastern Ukrainians. So his goal was to get people to subscribe to a narrative, and that is a political goal. Just like when I spoke to US and UK soldiers who've served in Afghanistan and said in the end, the goal became not to militarily defeat the Taliban, but to convince the local population not to join them, which is a political goal. And for these goals, especially in 2014, when social media is in full swing, social media is vital because that's how you get your message out, especially to the young, and that's how you get it out rapidly and to as many people as possible.
So it's less about establishing any sort of a military objective, establishing a beachhead, than it is about establishing a media foothold.
Absolutely. It's about establishing a narrative. And that is what it's about. And that narrative can be, the Kiev government is a fascist junta that wants to, persecute all of you Eastern Ukrainian Russian speakers, all the way to Hillary Clinton is a pedophile who ran a pedophile ring out of a pizzeria.
All that stuff. How different were the actual events on the ground in eastern Ukraine, as you understood them, from what were being reported on social media?
Well, it obviously depends on who you spoke to. you know, in the sort of pro-Kremlin media space, there was, you know, I mean, it was the difference between night and day, you know. It was seen as, you know, an attack on peaceful separatists, when in fact, you know, the separatists were initiating a lot of the violence. And again, it was, you know, I mean, it was, if, let's say, you know, the Ukrainian army was never described as the Ukrainian army, always as volunteer regiments, which had, you know, rightly deserved reputation, in some cases, for having some nasty far-right elements. So it was about language. But really what it was, it wasn't so much saying that X or Y didn't happen. It was the framing put around it. So if the Ukrainian army fought a battle with Ukrainian separatists, it would be Ukrainian fascists have attacked Donbass freedom fighters who are protecting Russians there. So it was all at the level of language, and obviously this is, you know, classic propaganda. It's the framing of events, and again it comes down to a narrative. So they weren't denying the battles were taking place, but they were completely distorting the reality through the use of language to tie into this overarching narrative that the Kremlin had pumped out directly from Putin's lift, in many cases, that they were protecting Russian speakers from Nazi Ukrainians.
Wow, there's just a whole lot more left to unpack here as we talk more with David Petrakarikas about his book, War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. We're speaking in rather general terms at the moment, but he's got quite a few examples in the book that really help illustrate the trend. And it's a concerning one. Join us back on the Jefferson Exchange by phone or by email when we return in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the longtime journalist David Petrakarikas. He is the author of a new book called War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. Facebook and Twitter, major weapons now used in war to tell narratives that may or may not be true, but certainly strengthen the case of the people who tell them. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I'm thinking back to what you were just saying a few moments ago about Clausewitz and the theory of war being politics conducted by other means. You know, since politics has gotten to be rather a post-truth place now, too, it just sounds like we've gotten to a place where facts are a whole lot less important than beliefs, and social media really works well on those.
You're absolutely right. A platform like Twitter, for example, even though it's just increased its character limit, it doesn't reward nuance, it doesn't reward thoughtfulness, it rewards the opposite. It rewards the sensationalist, it rewards the abusive, and it rewards shallowness of thought. It makes it perfect for Donald Trump, to be honest.
So 280 characters isn't going to make a difference, you think?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, perhaps you might pack a bit more nuance into a statement or a tweet, but this is the problem, and it's the problem we have with propaganda, because propaganda is about certainty, and you have the charisma of certainty. So someone can stand up, Donald Trump can stand up and say, I have brought back X many jobs to the U.S., when it's totally not true. Whereas, the reality is, well, look, on the one hand, this has happened. On the other hand, this else has happened. So if you look at the confluence of factors, but nobody wants to hear that. What's far more exciting, what's far more charismatic is the bold statement. And this is something demagogues have used throughout history. And we have platforms, actually, that reward these sorts of behaviors, that are want pithy statements or single striking images. And that is why, and rewards the sensationalist. And this is what I always tell people now. You know, do not confuse popularity with quality. Because things that go viral are often go viral because they're sensationalist. And our things that are sensationalist are, you know, often have a tendency to be untrue, or at the very least, deeply exaggerated.
So we end up with a new creature, as you coined the term, homo digitalis.
Yes. So this is the networked individual. someone, you know, who has access to Facebook, Twitter, who can reach people at other ends of the earth, that can use these tools. You know, in Ukraine, Facebook is used by volunteers to crowdsource everything from socks to body armor, bulletproof vests, night vision goggles for the army that's badly, badly underfunded. At the same time, Hodo Digitalis is used by the Russians to sit in troll factories, you know, posting fake news on Twitter and Facebook and VKontakte, which is the Russian version of Facebook, anywhere that news is discussed. Although, actually, I should actually say I have a problem with the term fake news, because it's not news in any traditional sense. It's propaganda or lies. So, actually, I think that's one term that should probably be slowly eased out of the lexicon. So Thoma Digitalis is the 21st century individual. And what we have seen, now people say power is moving from west to east. Now, you can debate that. But one thing that is certain is that power is transferring from hierarchies, by which I mean institutions like governments or large media organizations, to individuals and networks of individuals. And you can see this most clearly in my book when you look at how the U.S. State Department, you know, a very powerful arm of the most powerful institution in the world, the U.S. government, simply could not cope with the volume and scale of ISIS propaganda coming out from a few thousand Twitter accounts. They were totally outgunned, totally overwhelmed, and they lost the battle of narratives because of that, and also because of the very nature of what they were, an institution. They were as a large bureaucracy. Every decision that they had to make had to go up the chain of command, had to be approved. Whereas Hodo Digitalis, the ISIS fanboys on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram, could move rapidly, had no chains of command, were diffuse, were all over the place, and frankly, just outflanked, outfought, and you know, outbattled the U.S. State Department, which finally, I'll just say, was also damned by something else, its very essence. Put simply, if you were a young, disaffected Muslim who ISIS was seeking to recruit, who is the last person or thing that you would listen to in the world? It's the U.S. government.
David Patrick Karakos is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. So in the example you just gave of ISIS, was ISIS ever as successful as its social media accounts would indicate it to be?
Well, the answer is actually yes, and this is a point that is made by Alberto Fernandez, who was head of the department charged with counteracting their propaganda. The simple fact is, propaganda always has to have some basis in reality. That's what the best propaganda has. So, you know, the idea that the Ukraine government is a fascist junta is absurd. There are, however, fascists in Ukraine. So in that case, the propaganda is very tenuous. In other examples, you know, it's very strong. If you look at the Allied posters about the dangers of Hitler during World War II, that was propaganda, sure, but it was based in reality. Now, what you saw with the explosion of ISIS, it exploded into public consciousness when it took Mosul, Iraq's second largest city. So between 2014 and early 2015, ISIS swept through Iraq, nearly unopposed. It conquered a third of Iraq and Syria. And, you know, its propaganda was accordingly strong. So the State Department was stuck. What could they say? They couldn't, because it's the U.S. is a democracy, it can't lie. They can't pretend to be who they're not. And Alberto Fernandez said, ISIS conquers a third of Iraq, and we're supposed to counteract that with a few tweets. It was trying to make bricks with hay. So at one point, ISIS's propaganda... What ISIS was as strong as its propaganda suggested, it had a victory narrative. Now, what is interesting is that since it is now all but defeated on the ground, as its physical caliphate is disappearing, its virtual caliphate is becoming stronger than ever, and it continues to live on. But how it lives on now is not through military victories on the ground, but through franchising out terror attacks. So whether it be in the US, whether it be in Paris, London, Brussels, you're seeing terror attacks carried out in the name of ISIS. And social media has allowed a terror group to do one thing that it never could before, to live on virtually when it's being defeated physically.
So its geographic scope of actual control is very limited now, but its reach is greater.
Absolutely. And it has to be greater because they're putting more emphasis on it, because It needs, look, ISIS is in the news-making business. It, in that sense, it's like Kim Kardashian, and you saw this when it would you know, announce things like the creation of an ISIS passport, the creation of ISIS an ISIS currency, things that were almost certainly never intended to happen, but they dominated the news cycle. And right now, its way of dominating the news cycle is through hideous terror attacks, just like it once was through vicious beheadings or immolations.
So there's a great history lesson here, a couple of them actually, but you indicate that it's not just a phenomenon of our times. When information technology goes through a revolution, it certainly changes the way people relate to and talk about each other. And the example you give is Gutenberg and the printing press.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not just that, but at every period of great, you know, a great advance in information technology comes a period of great instability. Now, Gutenberg invented the printing press. This allowed the Bible to be printed en masse, which allowed, in turn, countries to translate it into their own language, i.e., not in, you know, into English, into German, into French, and not just in Latin, which meant that priests no longer became the sole mediators between the texts and the majority of the people. And what happened was the Reformation and, you know, the great wars of religion. Now, if you look at another great informational advancement, that came in the 1920s with the mass emergence of TV and radio, which just a decade later gave platforms to demagogues like Mussolini and Hitler. And we saw what happened there. Now, I'm not saying that a big war is coming. What I am saying is that every period where a new information technology is released or, you know, occurs, a period of great instability follows. And we're seeing that now. It's a very unstable time. And unfortunately, it's a bit of a case of chicken and egg. I mean, new information technology has coincided with a systematic discrediting of some of the fundamental institutions that make up the West, and you can trace it. 2003, our politicians were discredited when they took us into Iraq for weapons of mass destruction that turned out not to exist. The 2008 financial crisis discredited the financial sector. The Snowden revelations discredited the security establishment. And you combine that with longer-term declining standards of trust in the media, and you get a perfect storm. And then along comes this, at the same time, that this technology, which does reward sensationalism, which does react against nuance and intelligent, deep thought, and you get a perfect storm. And the eventual emergence is Donald Trump.
So the lesson becomes, let's not take it from the traditional news media, let's take it from each other, because we can talk to each other now.
Exactly.
War in 140 Characters is David Patrick Karakos's book, subtitled How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. You can join our conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you profile a handful of people who use this, and I want to hear first about Farah Baker, a big player in Gaza during the 2014 Hamas-Israeli war.
Absolutely, and there is a classic example of what I term homo digitalis. During the 2014, Farah was 16 years old. She was, I mean, to all intents and purposes, a child. In a very, you know, and a female as well, in what is a very patriarchal society, normally would have been just about the most powerless person in a war that you could think of. But because she had access to one thing alone, a smartphone, which everybody, you know, perhaps parts of Africa accepted and very poor parts of Asia, but the majority of the world has a smartphone, she could become a soldier in what was an information war. And she became a very good soldier because she tweeted in English. She was loved by the media because she was telegenic. She had blue eyes. And she was able to chronicle a narrative of Palestinian suffering that really caught on. And she was picked up by all the major newspapers, and the effect that she had at the information level, while it almost certainly didn't affect Israel's military calculations, you know, in terms of turning public opinion against Israel, in terms of highlighting Palestinian suffering, in terms of playing a role like that, she was vital, which is why I say now that what we're witnessing is a form of virtual war, a form of virtual mass enlistment. When does one become an actor in a war? If you're sitting in Gaza and a bomb drops and you two dead children are there and you take a photo and you tweet that and it's picked up, you've become a soldier for the cause, haven't you? And it's mass enlistment, and the barriers to entry are literally non-existent. All you need is a phone and access to the internet. Anyone can join up. And you see the opposite case when with the Russian troll. All you need is a guy with basic literary skills. They hook him up to a computer, and he becomes, you know, an online soldier for the Kremlin cause. And every fake article he writes, every meme he tweets, becomes one more virtual bullet fired into cyberspace in Russia's war against Ukraine or indeed the U.S.
So let's pause at this point, because we do marvel at Russia's involvement in social media, but are the Americans very far behind?
The answer is yes and no. Russia, this is another thing that emerges from my studies, is that, for a start, dictatorships, and Russia is in all but name a dictatorship, it's technically a democracy, but it's not really, have an advantage over democracies in that Russia can set up these troll farms. They can pretend to be who they're not. They can hack into other people. Now, obviously, the U.S. has hacking capabilities and stuff, but the U.S. does not have troll farms that interfere with other people's elections. If it did that, it would very quickly be picked up by the U.S. media, and it would be shut down fairly quickly, I'd imagine. So they are constrained. Secondly, people are catching on, but the Russians have been ahead of this game for quite a while now, and I think they really honed their tactics in Ukraine. There is a General Gerasimov, who is extremely senior in the Russian military, and he wrote something they call the Gerasimov Doctrine. And to paraphrase it, at one point he says, we are understanding now that non-military means can be even more effective than military means. And they understood this in Ukraine, where, as I say, the goal was to get people to subscribe to a particular narrative. So in that sense, they've honed the techniques a lot better than the U.S., and I would say they are the leaders in the field, but people are catching up to this now.
All right, let's take a call here. We have Jacob in Springfield. Thank you for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Patrick Karakas, the author of War in 140 Characters.
So I have two comments. The first is just an opening statement, but I think what happened on the election of 2016 was equivalent of a cyber Pearl Harbor, but to the extent we're not as smart as we were in the 40s, because 90% of Americans deny that it will happen, that it even happened, and even the President of the United States, it'd be like if FDR didn't even acknowledge that Pearl Harbor happened at the time Pearl Harbor happened. And 90% of us are in denial that it happened.
All right.
So I wanted to point out something in the mental health field that makes us more susceptible, of democracy more susceptible to propaganda. According to the NIH, National Institutes of Health, they quoted up to 45% of Americans are sometime in their life susceptible to a diagnosable mental illness. And if that seems high, I mean, you look at the rates of alcoholism, drug abuse, like with fentanyl.
Mm-hmm. All right, so somebody shorten this up a little bit. So the point being that we're more susceptible to social media? Is that
if humans are susceptible to mental illness, okay, with a little bit, literally if you say 45% or one half of our population has some type of diagnosable mental illness, and let's call them the deplorables. If you take 45%, you add 5%, you win an election.
All right.
In an election, one candidate may be crazy.
All right, let's get a response. Thanks for that, Jacob.
That's how.
Thank you, Jacob. David, want to talk that we're in here?
Yeah, I mean... I'm not quite sure on the figures on mental health, but to call it a Pearl Harbor may be slightly over-exaggerating it somewhat, but there is an element of denial here. Yes, I do think. I think, look, we have to sort of wait for the whole process to play out to see the extent of Russian meddling. But to the degree that large portions of the population refuse to believe that it happened, and that might be for party political reasons and political partisanship, then I think the caller was right. You know, we are in denial. We have to understand, and what people, I think, are beginning to understand, but they're still in denial about, is the dark side of social media. It was sold to us as this information utopia, this dream of a connected world that would bring us all together. And while to a degree it has, it's also split us apart. It's also made us cocoon in our own echo chambers, which has created the potential for greater division, greater hatred, greater political splintering, and greater conflict, unfortunately.
So I'm still really fascinated by the way that states get involved in this, and not just Russia, because we were talking about Farah, who was 14 years old and documented the Israeli attacks on Gaza. I mean, so but then you get into the Israelis having this spokesperson's unit that that works in opposition to things like that.
Absolutely, and this is going to be what every single military is going to have now, because you have to look at the nature of warfare. I mean, since World War II, in the what we call, let's say, the globalized West, or indeed amongst the major powers, there's not been any state-on-state conflict against major powers. When the U.S. went into Iraq, actually the battle against Saddam's forces was nothing. It was the insurgency that really caused the problems. What states like the U.S., the U.K., Israel now deal with is asymmetric warfare, whether it's ISIS, whether it's an Iraqi insurgency, whether it's a Taliban insurgency, the U.S. is dealing with insurgency. It's not fighting the German army. It's not fighting the Russian army. And in asymmetric warfare, what happens is that it's not so asymmetric anymore, because at the information level, the Palestinians can have a Farah, a 16-year-old girl, who can affect war at the information level. So asymmetric warfare isn't so asymmetric anymore.
Back with David Patrick Karakas and War in 140 Characters on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is David Patrick Karakas, a longtime journalist who has covered many wars, and he lets us in on another one as he looks at war and social media and how much war has changed, with social media as not only an additional but often a central component. David's book is called War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange by phone, 800-838-3760, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about asymmetrical war, where the Americans fighting the Iraqi army in 2003 wasn't really the main issue. It became the Americans versus an insurgency, which is not a real symmetrical, you know, black versus white army on the field kind of thing. Given that, I mean, I guess I'm overstating the obvious here, but so when we get wars that are just sort of drag on with a bunch of different actors involved, we're not going to have the big surrenders and the ceremonies that ended World War I, World War II, for example.
You're absolutely right, Jeff. And this is the problem that we face. And when war and politics become blurred, things are dangerous, because politics never ends. If a soldier today is killed in Afghanistan, a U.S. soldier, is he or she a victim of the 2001 war? The answer is we don't know, and that's the point.
For people seeking information, then, when it is being lobbed around, and I keep coming back to Farah in Gaza back in the 2014 Hamas-Israel war, and then Israel having the spokesperson's unit to fight back on the same level, for people who are seeking information of a certain quality, you know, veracity, looking for something that might actually have at least an element of truth to it, how do they determine who has authority? How do they establish that? And is it a very different answer based on age?
Absolutely. It is a different answer. And this is the problem we have. You take the 2014 war as a classic example. Now, if you watched a war on TV, if you watched a war, we consumed a war 20 years ago. Let's say there was an Israeli-Palestinian war 20 years ago. Pro-Israeli supporters and pro-Palestinian supporters would both watch CNN or the BBC. They'd both read the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or whatever paper. The point being that they'd be looking at the same material. They'd be looking at the same footage. They'd be reading articles by professional journalists with standards of objectivity. Now, they could obviously draw their own conclusions from watching the same footage. Their own biases would come into play. But they were looking at the same reality and reading about fundamentally the same reality. Now, Gilad Lotan, a researcher, he mapped a graph full of nodes as to where pro-Palestinians and where pro-Israelis got their information about the 2014 war. And the cluster of pro-Palestinian sources and pro-Israeli sources had absolutely no overlap whatsoever, except for one node, which is the left-leaning Israeli newspaper Haaretz. Now, what that means is not only were pro-Palestinians by definition pro-Palestinians, all their information was coming from pro-Palestinian sources. So their actual reality, the informational reality they had about the war, was entirely constructed, and the same for the pro-Israelis. And when that happens, you cannot, when your reality is constructed, not by a media organization that does have standards of looking at both sides and trained journalists, when your information reality is constructed, the chance for compromise, the chance to understand the other person's point of view, the chance for hatred to flourish becomes greater, and for the former, it decreases drastically. So, you know, who has authority depends on who you want to have authority. You know, whose narrative believes you want to believe depends on, what, first of all, whose narrative you want to believe, and secondly, whose is the most compelling, whose is the most sensationalist, whose is the most charismatic. And often, the most charismatic and sensationalist come from the Kremlin or someone like Donald Trump. And that is a danger.
So let's come back to the whole Kremlin, and particularly let's focus on Ukraine's situation, because that's heavily covered in the book. What set Ukraine on fire in November of 2013?
Yeah. It was the fact that its president, Viktor Yanukovych, was supposed to sign a pro-EU or an EU trade association agreement, which would have drawn Ukraine closer to the EU. Now, this was clearly unacceptable to Vladimir Putin. He wanted Ukraine to join Russia's customs union. And at the last minute, Yanukovych caved to Moscow's pressure, and he signed that instead of the EU agreement. The people came out onto the streets. Yanukovych did something very silly, and he started shooting them. And then it got worse and worse and worse, and he had to flee. That was essentially why Euromaidan happened. This became an existential threat for Putin, because Russians obviously saw their Ukrainians going into the streets and removing, essentially, to all intents and purposes, a dictator. And this was not a precedent that Putin was happy about, so he went in, took Crimea, and has been destabilizing Ukraine ever since.
So this brings a character into the mix involving social media, Anna Sandalova. Who's she?
Yes, so Anna is, again, class example of homo digitalis. She was a PR executive who'd taken time off work to raise her children. And she was on Maidan, on the square, and she wanted to help out. And she started using Facebook, secret Facebook groups to, you know, to organize, hey, does anyone have blankets that we can give to protesters because it's winter and they're sleeping out on the square. Then she started by raising funds. And she realized she could use Facebook, you know, for logistics, to mobilize people, to amplify messages, all the qualities of social media. And she took it once the war started in eastern Ukraine, and she saw how badly the soldiers were, how badly equipped they were, how underfunded they were. She began to use Facebook as a megaphone to get her message out, and as a way to mobilize, to get volunteers, but most of all, as a way to fundraise. And so she got people to donate to her personal page, and she was able to buy badly needed materials from everything ranging from bulletproof vests, body armor, night vision goggles, to socks and chocolates for soldiers fighting in the East. Now, again, she is homo digitalis because she simply would not have been possible in the pre-social media age. What would she have done? I mean, she could have put an advert in a local newspaper, which, first of all, would have been expensive had she tried to do it at the national level, let alone the international level. She wouldn't have been able to afford it. It would have run for maybe 3 issues or 4 issues or however long, and then, you know, gone. And now she has a Facebook page that can be seen by anyone anywhere in the world, and is seen by people because they're big Ukrainian diasporas in Canada, in the US, that have donated. And her message can go viral. She receives funds from all over the world, and she can receive thousands of dollars in a matter of hours if she has a particularly urgent request.
Which really strikes a note with me, to think about the fact, okay, she couldn't buy ads in a national newspaper because it was too expensive. Facebook's out there for free.
Exactly.
And why was she using Facebook? It's English. And so, I mean, instead of VKontakte or something in a Russian. Or...
Yeah, that's a very good point. Because a lot of Ukrainians prefer Facebook, especially now. I mean, as things have got worse with Russia, VKontakte is actually banned in Ukraine.
Oh.
Now you can't access
it. Okay, there you go.
But it wasn't then. But, yeah, no, I asked her the same thing as well. It was just what most people used in the non-eastern parts of Ukraine.
But the larger point then becomes the power of the conduit that
Absolutely.
Is silent. I mean, Facebook could change things instantly.
Absolutely. And this is why you have this new breed of person called homo digitalis. They have abilities that were not possible in the social media age. And, you know, they use these abilities for various purposes. If you look at Elliot Higgins, he's an online gamer who played, you know, who would spend days playing World of Warcraft, had an obsessive personality, learned how to manage groups of people online, took these exact skills, and ended up proving that the Russian army provided the missile that shot down flight MH17 over eastern Ukraine. And the key thing is, the Russian government has come out to directly contradict his findings. Now, the very idea that the government of the world's largest country would actually have to come out and refute the findings of one guy sitting quite often literally in his living room with the help of a few friends would have been unthinkable even 10 years ago. Now they have teams of foreign ministry spokespeople, you know, assigned to discrediting his work. And he's still just now, okay, he's got a bit more backing, but it started as him and just a couple of guys on Twitter. Incredible.
It really is. But let's talk about the state responses, though. When you do introduce us to a troll, the chapter is called "The Troll: The Empire Strikes Back." Vitaly Bespalov, tell us a bit about him.
Well, again, I mean, Vitaly was a journalist. He's actually a very liberal guy. He lost his job at a news website in St. Petersburg, and he needed a job. He sent out loads of resumes. He got a call back. He didn't even know what it was. And it turned out it was this troll farm, this troll factory. And it was quite incredible, Jeff. He worked on the first floor writing fake news articles with a URL that ended in .ua to pretend that they were Ukrainian. On the second floor, people created pro-Kremlin and anti-Ukraine and anti-American memes. On the third floor were the fake bloggers pretending to be Ukrainian, saying there's no electricity in half of Kiev, our kindergartens have nothing to eat, or pretending to be Americans, saying we support Putin's war on Ukraine, Ukrainians are fascists. And it was a merry-go-round of lies, because often the American quote-unquote blogger would become, on the writing on the third floor, would become a source for the fake articles on the first floor. So it was a merry-go-round of lies. And on the fourth floor, they had the Facebook and Twitter and VKontakte trolls that would go out there and post fake articles, would post propaganda, and would try and, you know, spam as much as possible. Now, what is so interesting about Russian propaganda in the 21st century is how different it is from traditional propaganda. Now, if you look at the Soviet Union, its propaganda was based on we are the ideal society, we are the utopia, we are a communist ideal where everybody is well-fed, everyone has a job. It was designed to promote a positive vision of the Soviet Union. Now, Russian propaganda doesn't seek to do that. This is what's so interesting. It doesn't seek to promote Russia as you know, an ideal society or an especially good place. I'm sure it would love to do that if it could, but it doesn't. Instead, what it does is it seeks to confuse and to sow as much doubt in people as possible. And it does this not by content, but through volume. So when MH17 was shot down, I was in Ukraine, and you just saw within minutes just so many theories, so many narratives, so many trolls coming on. It wasn't the Russians. It was the Ukrainians that shot down the plane. It was the Americans that shot down the plane. It was the Ukrainians and the Americans that shot down the plane. The point wasn't, I mean, all of these arguments were ludicrous if you looked at them within for a few minutes. But there was so much of it that it drowned out the truth. And this is the point of Russian propaganda. It is to spin so much disinformation that it will affect people's ability to recognize the truth when they see it. And that is the goal. And this is what you end up with. You end up with the post-truth politician. And you go all the way from Vladimir Putin to Donald Trump. Now, both men are still very different. One is a dictator in all but name. And the other is, you know, leads the world's largest democracy. But in both cases, the goal is the same. And it is not to twist the truth like the politicians of old. It is to deny the very fact that an objective truth exists at all. So you go from Bill Clinton, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, just a lie, to Donald Trump or his spokesman, who can say my inauguration crowds were bigger than Barack Obama's, when you can see that they weren't. And what happens in response? Kellyanne Conway comes out and says, oh, well, we're just offering alternative facts. There is no objective truth. Everything is just a narrative or a version, and that is truly dangerous.
We have an email here from Liz who says, this is a fascinating subject, but it is naive to say the U.S. does not interfere using this method, though the CIA and military are still much more effective tools for, quote, influencing elections and toppling elected governments. I mean, I'm hearing this a lot, that people are thinking we're getting some comeuppance in America.
Look, has America interfered in elections in its history? Absolutely, of course. I mean, Latin America is a classic example. But in the form in which the Russians do it, are there equivalent American troll farms? No, they're not. Absolutely not. They don't exist in that way. And if an American, the Russian troll farms have been exposed in the Russian media, I'm fairly certain that if something equivalent was discovered in America, it would be shut down rapidly. Does the U.S. spy on other governments? Of course it does. Does it hack? Of course it does. But what I'm saying is, in its messaging efforts, in its own, and it called propaganda, does it employ trolling and stuff in this way? No, it doesn't. It simply doesn't. There is an argument to say, well, America's dominated the world, it's interfered in loads of other people's elections, now it's getting a taste of its own medicine. I find it to be a little bit facile, because interfering in democracy is just bad for everybody. So that would be my argument, my response to that.
All right. Well, it's a very compelling book, and we learn a lot about what goes on in the world. And darn Twitter for changing it to 280 characters right after you got this out on the books.
Indeed. Yeah. Selfish Twitter.
All right. David Patrick Karakas, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book, War in 140 Characters, How Social Media is Reshaping Conflict in the 21st Century. David, thanks a lot.